No. If you weren't looking for the King's Guard, what were you doing? The room reeled in my vision. I saw a red haze, and in it Delaunay, Alcuin, everyone I had loved, and behind it the face of Narmar, compassionate and giving, and the stern bronze features of Kushiel, in whose hand I dwelt. I don't know. My own voice seemed to come from a great distance. Ask Jocelyn what he meant, if you haven't killed him. Ah, no. You've warned him, my dear. A Castlean would sooner die than betray his oath, Melisande whispered. So close I could feel her lips move. I closed my eyes and shuddered. And anyway, I would rather ask you. Chapter 39. It was the jolting of the cart that woke me. My first impressions were purely sensory, and none of them pleasant. It was cold and dark. I lay atop straw, prickling my cheek, beneath rough-spun woolen blankets, and from the incessant lurching motion and the sound of hooves, it was a cart in which I rode, lashed over with a canvas tarpaulin. That much I apprehended, before a wave of nausea gripped my belly. I, who had never known a sick day in my life, scarce knew what it was. It was pure instinct that sent me crawling across the straw to the farthest corner of my confines, where I promptly spewed up the meagre contents of my stomach. Afterward, the sick feeling gripped me less urgently. Shivering with cold and light-headed, I made my way back to the nest of blankets in which I had awoken, seeking the measure of miserable comfort they offered. It was then that I saw the second figure, half-buried under the woolens, blonde hair blending into straw, dim grey clothing rendering him nearly invisible in the faint light that filtered around the lashed edges of the canvas above us. Jocelyn. Memory returned in a relentless surge. I barely made it back to the corner in time to vomit bile. This time the noise of it woke him. I wrapped my arms around myself and huddled, shivering, watching him glance around the darkened interior of the cart, frowning. A good Castlean warrior, he took stock of his weapons first. They were gone, daggers and sword both, and the steel vambraces from his forearms. Then he saw me.
"Where?"
Jocelyn's voice cracked. He paused and cleared his mouth, drug-dried, working his tongue and swallowing.
"Where are we?"
"I don't know," I whispered, not sure if it was true. Outside, hoofbeats, a team of four. There were too many beats, Steel Shard and Marshal. Soldiers rode with us, a dozen at least.
"Melisande," he said, remembering. "Melisande Sharazai."
"Yes."
"That too," I whispered.
Memories crowded my mind, beating like dark wings. I had never until that awakening known what it was to despise the very nature of what I am. Even now, in cold and pain and misery, I could feel the residual languor of my body's infinite betrayal. Naive as he was, Jocelyn was no fool. He was young enough to learn, and he had served a time in Delaunay's household, where even a fool might gain some measure of wisdom. I saw understanding dawn on his clear-cut features.
"Did you give her Rouse's message?" he asked quietly.
"No." I shook my head as I said it, and couldn't stop, shaking and chattering, huddling in onto myself. "No, no, no."
This was beyond his ken. Alarmed, Jocelyn reached out for me, drawing me back to the warmth of the blankets, piling them around me, and at last, when my shaking continued unabated, wrapping his own arms around me and rocking me to stillness, murmuring meaningless sounds. It was true. Everything, everything else she had desired of me, every betrayal flesh could afford, she had had. Numb and heartsick and broken, I had yielded it all. But not that. I think at the last she even believed it. I remembered her relenting, lifting up my drooping head by a clutch of hair, that beautiful face and merciless, gentle smile. I had pleaded, my voice raw. I could only shape the word and beg with my eyes. "I believe you, Fedra," she said, caressing my face. "Truly, I do. You have only to say the word if you want it to end. You have only to say it." If I had said it, given the signal, I would have given her the rest. So I didn't. And it didn't end. Not for a long time. I remembered it all now, but I had stopped shaking. I carried the memory of it inside, like a cold stone in the center of me. Jocelyn grew suddenly aware of the situation and awkward with it, giving my shoulders a brusque chafing and withdrawing his embrace. He didn't move far away, though. We had nothing here but each other. I watched him repress a shiver and silently unwrapped one of the blankets, handing it to him. He didn't refuse, but drew it around him and blew on his hands. "So you don't know what's befallen us?" he asked eventually. I shook my head. "Well," he said resolutely, "let's see what we can learn." He blew once more on his hands to warm them, then pounded on the side of the cart and shouted, "Heya! You outside! Stop the cart!" The wooden clapboards rattled under his assault. Outside I could hear the shuffle of riders and a muttering. "Stop the cart, I say! Let us out!" A tremendous blow from the other side shocked the boards. A quarter-staff or a mace at least. Jocelyn snatched his hands back, stung by the reverberation of the wood. Another fierce blow descended onto the taut canvas, landing on his shoulder with a dull thud. Grimacing, Jocelyn rolled out of the way of a second blow. "You in the cart, keep it down," a male voice said in a soldier's clipped tones, "or we'll beat you like badgers in a sack. Understood?" Jocelyn crouched low beneath the canvas, eyeing it warily, as he tried to track the shadow of a weapon above him. "I am Jocelyn Verai, son of the Chevalier Milar Verai of Siovall, member of the Castellan Brotherhood, and you are holding me against my will," he called. "Do you understand that this is both heresy and a crime punishable by death?" The weapon, a staff by its reach, came down on the canvas again with another muffled thump. "Shut up, Castellan. Next time I aim for the girl." I caught Jocelyn's arm and shook my head at him as he opened his mouth to retort. "Don't," I murmured. "Don't make it worse. There are a dozen or more fully trained, armed and mounted soldiers out there. If you're going to play the hero, at least pick a moment when you're not outnumbered and trapped like a badger in a sack." Jocelyn stared at me.
"How do you reckon the odds?"
"Listen." I nodded around the cart, horses and armor creaking, four before and two aft, two on the sides, and I've heard at least two riding scout, and if they're under Melisande's orders, likely they're Deglamore's men.
Deglamore?
He was still staring, but he had the sense to keep his voice low.
What's he got to do with it?
I don't know. Cold, sick and weary, I huddled under my blankets. But whatever it is, they're in it together. They brought down House Trevelyan, and his men killed Delaunay and Alcuin. He bid for Isandra's hand. I think he means to have the throne, one way or another. And if they're Deglamore's men, you may be sure they're well trained. His face showed perplexity in the dim light.
I thought you were but a servant of Nama.
Did you learn nothing of what we were about in Delaunay's house? I asked bitterly.
Better if I was, and had stayed in the night court, gone to Valyrian to be a whipping toy to ham-fisted tradesmen. Then Melisande Charizai would not have had me to use as her hunting dog and flush out Delaunay's allies.
Is that what happened?
He checked himself, shaking his head.
Fedra, you couldn't have known. And Arfiel Delaunay should have, to use his bondservants that way. It's not your fault.
To blame or no, I said softly, it doesn't matter. I was the cause. Delaunay is dead, and Alcuin too, who never harmed anyone in his life, and everyone else foolhardy enough to serve him. I caused it.
Phaedra.
It's getting darker, I interrupted him, holding my hand out. It was harder to see than before. Mayhap they'll make camp come nightfall. We've been going north, I think. It's colder than in the city.
Cumlach,
he said it grimly. It may well be. They would be wary inside the borders of Lanyas. They ordered us to be silent, not still. They fear detection. If it's so, they might be less cautious in their own province.
Delaunay taught you well, he murmured.
Not well enough. Worn out with fear and pain, I dozed for a time, waking only when the cart came to an abrupt halt. Utter darkness surrounded me. Then came the sound of men and chains rattling, and the rear gate of the cart opened. I squinted into blinding torchlight, flames streaking my vision.
"Come out," a harsh voice said from behind the swimming flames. "You first, girl. Come out slowly."
Still clutching my blankets around me, I crawled out the back of the cart to stand blinking and squinting in the firelight, half frozen and covered with straw. Rough hands took hold of me, guiding me toward a campfire. A helmeted soldier handed me a water skin, and I drank greedily.
All right, easy, Carceline.
They were more cautious, allowing Jocelyn to emerge, but he came docilely enough, his first concern for my safety. He was a Carceline brother, and I was his charge. No matter what had befallen him, obeying that oath was foremost. I saw it in the relief in his face. As my eyes adjusted to the firelight, I saw I had guessed near enough. There were some 15 soldiers in unmarked gear, but professionals all. One tended a stew pot over the fire, while others sought the horses, and a full half-dozen surrounded Jocelyn with drawn blades. Our encampment was in a rocky valley, mostly frozen turf with a dusting of snow, and wooded mountains rising all around. Searching the mountainsides, I saw no other fires flickering. We were alone here.
"Come on, Carceline, that's right."
From his tone of command, I took the soldier chivying Jocelyn along at sword point to be their leader.
"Here, give him a drink," he added, catching a water skin that someone tossed him. "There you go."
Jocelyn drank, but I could see the banked fury in his face. He handed the water skin back to the leader.
"In the name of the prefect of the Carceline Brotherhood," he said quietly, "I demand to know who you are and why you have done this to us."
Laughter rose around the campfire.
"In the name of the prefect of the Carceline Brotherhood," the leader echoed him in mincing tones, then struck Jocelyn a sharp blow to the head with one gauntleted fist. "In the borders of Cumlach, the only order we obey is the order of steel, Carceline."
Jocelyn's head snapped back at the blow, and his eyes glittered.
"Then give me mine, and try its metal."
Encouraging shouts came from the soldiers, but their leader shook his head regretfully.
"I'd like to, boy, for you're angry enough to try for my head, and it would be an entertaining challenge. But my orders are to keep you alive."
He jerked his chin at me. "You girl, you need to use the latrine." Unfortunately, I did. For anyone who has never had to relieve themselves in the watchful presence of an armed guard, I do not recommend it. Jocelyn had an escort of 6, but he is a man, and considerably more accustomed to such company. Thus humiliated, I was ushered back to the campfire and issued a bowl of stew. I ate it and said nothing. Silence is the first skill I learned. In the night court, silence is common wisdom for a child. In Delaunay's household, it was taught us for other reasons. Jocelyn followed my lead and held his tongue until the leader beckoned for a flask one of his soldiers carried.
"You're to drink some,"
he said, holding out the flask. It gleamed in the firelight. I could guess what was in it. More of the drug we'd been given before. Jocelyn looked up remotely beside me, and I could sense his body coiling.
"No,"
he said mildly, and exploded into action,
lunging forward to deliver a sharp chop to Valida's throat. The man staggered backward, struggling for breath, and the flask fell with a faint chink to the ground. The other soldiers moved belatedly to surround the whirling Castellan as Jocelyn fought with hands and feet, limbs moving in a blur of precisely executed movements.
He might have succeeded against fewer men. 6 or 8, I would even believe. He'd taken them by surprise. But their leader got his wind back and his voice. Roaring, he waded into the fray, kicking a loose blade away from Jocelyn's reaching grasp.
"Wear your swords, you idiot! Don't let him get armed!"
They surrounded him, pressing him hard, and then someone brought the pommel of a dagger down hard atop his head, and Jocelyn sagged to his knees. Cursing, one of the soldiers he'd injured stepped up and drew back his blade to run him through.
"Stop!"
I hadn't even realized I was on my feet until I heard my own voice shout fiercely. The man stayed his hand. They were all staring at me. I had remembered the rest of it, and drew up the few ragged ounces of dignity I could summon.
"If this man dies, you'll be accountable to Melisande Charizai for it," I said coldly. "Sooner or later, one way or another. Do you want to take that chance?"
The soldier considered it and glanced at his leader, who nodded. He sheathed his sword. At a word, Valida had the flask retrieved.
"Hold him,"
he ordered, and the two men wrenched Jocelyn's arms behind his back, while two others held him. The leader uncorked the flask and grabbed Jocelyn's chin, forcing the neck of the flask between his teeth and tipping it, while another soldier pinched his nostrils shut. Jocelyn choked and sputtered, clear liquid spilling out the corners of his mouth, but a good deal of it went down his throat. It took effect quickly, and he pitched forward onto the ground.
"Tie his arms behind him," the leader ordered. "He'll give us less trouble."
He came toward me, holding out the flask.
"Lady, I hope you'll not give me the same."
"No, my lord." It was the first time I could recall using a formal address sarcastically. I took the flask from his hand and drank. He took it back, eyeing me wryly.
"You needn't take that tone, you know. I've treated you fair and kept my men off you, and it's the last kindness you'll like to see, where you're going, lady. It's a strange way to keep someone alive, that's all I've to say."
That much I heard, and then darkness claimed me. I was vaguely aware of being lifted and slung back into the straw of the cart, feeling Jocelyn's limp form near me, and hearing the gate chained behind us. Slipping down into unconsciousness, I heard again what I had remembered. Melisande's voice, at the end tender and rich.
"Don't worry, my dear. I'd no more kill you than I'd destroy a priceless fresco or a vase," she had said, somewhere beyond my failing vision. "But you know too much, and I can't afford the risk of keeping you here. It may not be much, but believe me when I say I'm giving you the best chance I can to stay alive. I'll even leave you the Castellan, and pray he does a better job protecting you than he's done so far." Her fingers twining in my hair, cruel and sweet. "When it's over, if you live, I'll find you. That much I promise, Fedra." Eloa helped me, but then... even then, there was a part of me that hoped she would. The Night Court taught me to serve, and Delaunay taught me to think. But from Melisande Charizai, I learned how to hate. My memories of the remainder of our journey are blurred. Wishing to take no further risks, the Carmeline leader kept us confined to the cart and drugged, allowed full consciousness and freedom only long enough to eat, drink, and relieve ourselves. I knew that the terrain grew harsher, and we entered the mountains, from the steep angle of the cart and the swearing of soldiers. I knew that we went further north, from the cold that gripped me night and day, even in my drugged and blood-stained dreams. But I didn't know where we were bound until they released us, stumbling and blinking in the bright light of day on a snowy plain beyond the Carmeline Mountains. 8 men, thewed like iron and clad in furs,
sat arrayed in a semicircle atop tall, shaggy horses, watching us. One of them, whose yellow hair was bound with a bronze fillet and whose moustaches flowed luxuriantly, tossed the Carmeline leader a stained leather sack that clinked with coin and made a comment to him in a guttural tongue. Jocelyn's lips parted and he frowned, straining to understand. I understood. It was Skaldic. He had just paid the purchase price for 2 Dangeline slaves. Chapter 40. From the speed with which the transaction occurred, I had no doubt that it was prearranged. The Carmeline leader handed the bag of coins to his second to count. At his affirmative nod, the leader cut the thongs that bound Jocelyn's wrists and ordered one of his men to leave our baggage. He fetched a wrapped bundle, the hilt of Jocelyn's sword protruding, and dumped it unceremoniously to the ground. At a word they wheeled their party and struck out toward the mountain pass, the rear guard keeping a vigilant eye on the Skaldi, who watched them go impassively. Jocelyn glanced from the retreating Carmelines to the impassive Skaldi, to me, with a look of utmost bewilderment. "What is it?" he asked me at last. "Have you any idea what they've done?" "Yes." I stood ankle-deep in snow, shivering under the bright sun. The sky overhead was a remarkable blue. "They've just sold us to the Skaldi." If his response was singular, Jocelyn's reactions were always swift. The words were scarce out of my mouth before he was scrambling for the pack and his sword, boots skidding in the snow. The Skaldi leader loosed a shout of laughter, whooping to his men. One of them spurred his shaggy horse forward, intercepting Jocelyn, who dodged. Another drew a short spear and thundered past the bundle, his mount's hooves spraying snow as he leaned down to pluck the pack neatly from the snow on the tip of his spear. Jocelyn veered toward him, and the Skaldi jerked his spear, tossing the pack to a comrade. They surrounded him then, laughing with ruddy cheeks and high spirits, tossing the bundle back and forth across the circle, while Jocelyn spun about hopelessly, floundering in snow. The Skaldi leader sat apart, grinning with strong white teeth, as he watched the entertainment. I wondered if the Carmelines had unbound Jocelyn's hands, knowing what would follow. It was worse than the Eglantine adepts taunting him in Knight's doorstep, and I stood it as long as I could before I threw away our one advantage. "Let him be!" I called to the leader in fluent Skaldic, raising my voice so it carried across the snow. "He does not understand!" His yellow eyebrows rose, but he betrayed no other sign of surprise. Jocelyn, on the other hand, had ceased his futile efforts and stood gaping at me as if I'd grown a third eye. The Skaldi leader waved negligently to his men and moved his horse over to stare down at me. His eyes were a light grey and disconcertingly shrewd. "Kilbahar's men didn't tell me you spoke our tongue," he mused. "They didn't know," I replied in it, doing my best to hold his gaze despite my shivering. Kilbahar. Silver hair, I thought, and remembered Isidore Deglamore's pale, shining hair. There are many things they do not know. The Skaldi gave his roaring laugh, tossing back his head. "Those are true words, Dangeline. You say your comrade does not understand. Do you?" I knelt in the snow as gracefully as my cold, stiffened joints would allow, and kept my gaze on his face. "I understand I am your slave, my lord." "Good." A look of satisfaction spread across his face. "Harold," he shouted to one of his men, "give my slave a cloak. These Dangelines are frail creatures, and I would not have her die of cold before she has a chance to warm my bed." It got a laugh. I didn't care, for a young man whose moustache was barely started rode over grinning and tossed me a thick garment of wolfskin. I wrapped it around me and pinned it with frozen fingers. "Thin blood," observed my Skaldi lord, "though they say it runs hot." Reaching down with one brawny arm, he lifted me into the saddle behind him. "You ride with me, little one. I am Gunther Arnlaugsson. Tell your companion to be wise." He wheeled his horse, bringing us broadside of the still-staring Castelline.
"Jocelyn, don't!" I said through chattering teeth. "They won't kill us out of hand. They paid too dear. Scaldi value their slaves."
"No." His blue eyes were fixed and wide, nostrils flared. "I failed you with Melisande Charizai, and I failed you with Deglamore's men. But I swear it, Fedra, I won't fail you here. Don't ask me to betray my oath." He lowered his voice. "The Scaldi sword is in your reach. Get it to me, and I swear I will get us out of here."
I didn't look. I could feel it, the leather-wrapped hilt protruding from Gunter's sword belt near my left elbow.
Jocelyn was right. It was in my reach.
And we were alone, in a frozen wasteland. Even armed, the Castelline was still outnumbered 8-1 by mounted Scaldi warriors.
"I have lived in servitude all my life," I said softly. "I'm not willing to die for your oath."
I touched Gunter's shoulder. He looked back at me, and I shook my head. "He is too proud," I said in Scaldic. "He will not heed." The shrewd grey eyes narrowed, and he nodded.
"Bring him," he called to his men. "And have a care he does not hurt himself on your spears," he added with another roar of laughter. It took all seven, and I had to watch it. I dare say Jocelyn himself had never known, until that moment, what true battle fury was. He fought like a beast at bay, bellowing with rage, and for a time I could see nothing but horses' bodies and thrashing limbs. He succeeded in wrenching a short spear loose from one of them, and kept them all at a distance then, jabbing and threatening. If it had been a more familiar weapon, I don't know. I cannot afford to guess.
"He looks like a girl," Gunter commented, his expression lively with interest. "But he fights like a man. Like two men."
"He is trained to it from childhood," I said in his ear. "D'Angelines have betrayed him, the man you call Kilbahar. Make him your friend, and he may fight for you against him."
It was a risk. Gunter's gaze slewed around to me, considering.
"Kilbahar is our ally," he said. "He pays us gold to raid your villages."
The shock of it went through me like a knife, but I kept it from showing on my features. "To have a traitor for an ally is to have an enemy in waiting," I said solemnly, silently blessing the number of hours I had spent translating Scaldic poetry. Gunter Arnlaugsen made no reply, and I kept my mouth shut, leaving him to think on it. His men, half of them dismounted, finally succeeded in bringing down the thrashing Jocelyn, wresting the spear from his grasp and forcing him face down in the snow.
"What shall we do with him?" one of them called.
Gunter thought about it a moment.
"Tie his hands and let him run behind your horse, Willy," he called. "We will tire the light from this wolf cub before we reach the steading."
It was quickly done, and we set out, riding beneath the bright blue sky. I clung awkwardly behind Gunter, pathetically grateful for the fur cloak and his burly frame blocking the wind, and trying not to look back at Jocelyn. They had bound his wrists before him, attaching a long thong like a lead, and one of the Scaldi held the end, forcing the Castelline to run behind his horse. Jocelyn floundered in the snow, sometimes losing his footing and being dragged, until the Scaldi halted and gave him time to gain his feet. His breath came raggedly, and his face was bright red with cold, but his eyes glared fierce blue hatred of everything and everyone around him. Including me. "Hate me," I thought, "and live, Castelline." It was nearing nightfall when we reached the steading, our shadows stretching long and black before us across the deep snows. Gunter made up a song as we rode and sang it aloud in a powerful voice about how he had outfoxed Kilbahar and captured a D'Angeline warrior prince and his consort. It was a good song, and I didn't bother to correct him. By that time I was so cold I could barely think. There were a handful of snug cottages in the steading and a great hall. The doors to the hall were flung open wide as we approached,
and men and women alike poured out shouting congratulations. Gunter dismounted, beaming, firelight from the hall catching the bronze fillet that bound his hair. He lifted me down from his horse and shoved me toward a knot of scaldi.
"See my new bed-slave," he roared. "Is she not fine?"
Hands grasped at me, prodding and examining. Too many faces, crowding close, ruddy and rough-hewn. I struggled free, searching for Jocelyn. He had sunk to his knees behind the Scaldi's horse, exhaustion compelling the obeisance that nothing else would. Whoever said the Castine Brotherhood was a humble order lied. His chest heaved, and his hair had come completely loose from its tidy club, rimed with frost. He glared through it at me. "Jocelyn," I murmured, cupping his cold face in my hands. He jerked his head away and spat at me. I felt Gunter's hands on my shoulders, drawing me away, tucking me under one massive arm.
"Look at him," he said jovially. "A proper wolf cub he is. Let him spend the night with the hounds then, eh?"
There was no shortage of willing hands to wrestle the Castline into submission. Laughing and shouting, a group of young men dragged him away. To the kennels, I could only surmise. I was spun around again by Gunter's grasp, propelled staggering into the warmth of the great hall.
"Shame on you, Gunter Arnlaugsen!"
The exclamation came from a woman against whom I fetched up like a bit of flotsam, stumbling away awkwardly. She was young and pretty enough by Scaldic standards, with sun-coloured hair and sharp blue eyes. At this moment she had both hands planted firmly on her hips, and her eyes were narrowed.
"The poor thing's half-frozen and terrified to death, and you're bragging about bed rights? No wonder you've not found a woman to warm it before this."
A round of laughter echoed from the rafters, and my fearsome Scaldi lord looked down and shuffled his feet before coming up with a retort.
"Ah, Hedwig, you know I've no need to go raiding over Dangeline borders if you would have me, lass," he said, grinning. "Now there's no telling what this little one can teach me, and you'll be sorry for the loss of it."
"Not tonight, you won't."
Despite the laughter his retort won, her reply was no less acerbic. "A bowl of warm soup and a turn by the fire, that's what you need, isn't it, child?" she said kindly.
"She's a barbarian, Hedwig. She can't understand a word of it," someone said good-naturedly.
"I understand," I said in Scaldic, struggling to make my voice heard. Still shivering under my fur cloak, I sank to my knees and grasped her work-roughened hand, kissing it. "Thank you, my lady." Embarrassed, Hedwig snatched her hand away.
"Gods above! We'll have none of that here, child. We're not savages. We don't make slaves crawl on their knees."
Gunter had not said as much, I thought, rising, and filed the thought for future usage. Clapping her hands, she shouted for a bowl of soup and ordered room made at the hearth for me. There was grumbling, but she was obeyed. I was in no shape to protest, even if I'd been minded to, which I was not. I took my seat by the fire, and the roaring heat of it slowly thawed the ice at the marrow of my bones. I could see Gunter in the hall, half a head taller than any other man there, boasting and making the best of the situation. Later I learned what that night should have been obvious. Hedvig's father had been the lord of the steading until his death. Gunter had won the leadership by might of arms, but had failed thus far in his campaign to win Hedvig's heart, and some of her father's legacy of command still clung to her. If I do not love the Scaldi, and I cannot, for what they sought to do to the land to which I was born, and which is ever a part of me, it is not in me to hate them either. I knew kindness at their hands. If I knew cruelty, and I did, it was no more and no less than the cruelty they inflicted upon each other, for theirs is a harsh and warlike culture. But it is not without its beauty, even if it is born of blood and iron, and as I have learned, it is not without compassion. Scaldi drink deep when celebrating, and they celebrated that night. Enough mead to drown a village flowed, and there were songs and fights and constant laughter. No one kept a close watch on me,
and I dare say if I had wanted to slip away, I could have done so. But where would I have gone? I was in no condition to flee across miles of snowy wastes through hostile territory. I thought of finding Jocelyn, freeing him, and attempting the flight, and I shivered. So it was that I stayed, while my new scaldy masters sang and boasted and drank and worried about Jocelyn freezing in the cold, until a hand took my shoulder, and I woke with a start, to realize I was drowsing. It was Hedvig, who took me kindly to her room, shooting baleful looks at an only semi-abashed Gunter. There she made up a pallet for me, of straw ticking and heaped blankets, alongside her own bed, and I curled up like a dog myself, and let sleep, honest sleep, claim me. Chapter 41. Thus began my period of slavery under the ownership of Gunter Arnlaugsen, Skaldic chieftain of one of the westernmost steadings held by the tribe of the Marsi, under the aegis, I would learn, of the great war-leader Voldemar Selig, Voldemar the Blessed. I was roused that morning by Hedvig, who showed me to my immense joy the bathing-room. The bath itself was nothing more than a tub of battered tin, but it was sized for Skaldi, which meant I had ample room to sit and wash myself. Hedvig showed me how to fetch water and stoke a fire to heat it, marvelling that I had no knowledge of such things. I may have been a servant all my life, I reflected, struggling with a heavy pail of water, but of a surety I had been a privileged one. Still, I had never known a bath so sweet as that first one I drew for myself in Gunter's steading. Even the lack of privacy, for Hedvig perched on a stool and observed, while other women came and exclaimed, could not diminish its pleasure.
"What do you call this?"
Hedvig asked, pointing at my mark, still unfinished, of course. I was glad, at least, that I had paid Master Tialar in advance. If ever I returned to the city of Elowa, surely he would honour our contract. I gave its name, translating as best I could into Skaldi, and explained that it was the sign of a servant of Narmar. This, too, required considerable explanation, which the women heard with puzzled looks.
"And these?"
Hedvig asked then, her hovering finger indicating the fading lines of Melisande Charizai's handiwork.
"This is part of the rituals?"
"No," I said shortly, pouring a dip of warm water over my skin. "That was not part of Narmar's rituals." Something in my tone stirred Hedvig to pity, and she shooed the other women out of the bath, remaining to help me out of the water and into a rough-spun woolen gown, so long on me that it dragged on the floor.
"We will have it hemmed," she said pragmatically, and loaned me her own chipped comb for my damp, tangled hair.
Washed and combed, I felt more properly myself than I had since Rouse's messenger had entered the Marquis's shop, and I endeavoured to take the measure of my situation. The great hall at the steading was a busy place. It is, I learnt, the heart of any Skaldi community. The outlying fields were held by Gunter's thanes or warriors, and farmed by their carls, who I took to be a class of peasants or bondsmen. For this privilege they supported the thanes and paid a tithe in herds and grains to Gunter. When Gunter and his thanes were not out raiding or hunting, they spent their time carousing in the hall, wagering on contests of strength and song. For all of this, Gunter was not a bad lord, as such things are reckoned. The Skaldi have an elaborate system of law, and he heard complaints twice a week, deciding fairly and impartially as he could. When a decision went against one of his thanes, and he was ordered to make reparation to one of his own carls for the unlawful stealing of a yearling bull-calf, he did it without grumbling. These things I observed over time. Then, on that first day, I merely kept my eyes open and my mouth closed, trying to make sense of it all. Of Gunter himself I saw nothing during the daylight hours. His thanes abounded in the hall, honing their weapons and working thick bear grease into their leather footwear, laughing and joking. They made comments aplenty, elbowing each other and eyeing me, but made no move to molest me, so I ignored it, silently thanking Elowa that it seemed I was Gunter's property alone, and not to be held in common among his men.
While the men idled and jested, the women worked tirelessly. There is a great deal to be done to keep the great hall in a steading functioning smoothly. Tending the hearths, preparing food, cleaning up after drunken warriors, mending and spinning and sewing. There were housecarls who helped with the heavier work, but much of it the women did themselves. Hedvig ordered them about with a tone much accustomed to being obeyed, not shirking to labour herself. When I asked her what my duties were to be, she waved me away, saying it was for Gunther to say. I asked then if it was permitted for me to leave the hall, for I was concerned for Jocelyn and wished to find him. She bit her lip and shook her head. Of her own accord, I think she would have permitted it, but she dared not cross Gunther so far as that. So I was confined to the hall and the attentions of Gunther's thanes. One of the youngest, Harald the Beardless, who had given me his cloak, was the most daring of them, and a skilled poet in the bargain. If my heart had been less a stone in those days, I might have blushed at some of his verses, which gave an exceedingly detailed inventory of my charms. It was amid one of the latter that Gunther burst into the hall, attended by a couple of his men, shouting for mead. I don't know where he had been all day, but he was glowing with the cold, snow clinging to his cloak and leggings. When he unclasped his cloak and slung it aside, I saw Melisande's diamond about his neck and gasped aloud. It was an incongruous thing, that glistening teardrop lying in the hollow of his powerful throat. I hadn't even had the sense to wonder about its loss. It had been amid our baggage. It seemed as untouchable to Deglamore's men as Jocelyn's castling weapons had been. No small wonder, I thought. I would sooner steal from the castling prefect than Melisande Sharazai. The sight of her diamond drew exclamations, and Gunther laughed, running one thick forefinger beneath the black cord. If I had thought about it, I would have welcomed its disappearance. But here it was now, again, dangling from the throat of my scaldy master. I felt Melisande's presence in my life like a touch, and despaired.
"Dangeline!"
Gunther shouted, catching sight of me sitting by the fire. I rose with an automatic curtsy, awaiting with bowed head as he strode across the hall.
"I have a powerful hunger upon me."
Strong hands closed about my waist, and he lifted me into the air, planting a loud kiss on my less than willing lips. Gunther roared with laughter, holding me suspended.
"Look at this," he shouted to his men. "These Dangeline women weigh no more than my left thigh. Think you she knows what a real man is?"
"Nor like to, at your hands," Hedvig retorted sharply, emerging from the kitchen with a ladle held in one hand like a sword. "Put the child down, Gunther Arnlaugsen."
"I'll put her down, flat on her back," he declared,
setting me back on my feet with another resounding kiss. I had never known such a hairy man, and it was strange to be kissed by him.
"There! What do you think of that, Dangeline?"
I had never hated any patron, having entered every contract freely in homage to Nama. I hated this man now, who would take me without consent, by virtue of an ownership he held through betrayal. "I am my lord's servant," I said stoically. Gunther Arnlaugsen was in high spirits. Sarcasm was lost on him.
"And a cursed fine one at that,"
he agreed cheerfully, picking me up once more and slinging me over his shoulder like a sack of meal.
"If I'm not back in 2 hours, send the barrel of ale and a rasher of meat," he called to his thanes, striding out of the hall.
I hung helpless as a child over his shoulder, listening to the shouts and jibes of his men as we left. I could feel his muscles working beneath his woolen jerkin. I swear it by Eloa and his companions, Scaldic warriors are unnaturally hale. In his modest quarters he set me down and turned to build up the fire in the hearth. His room was simple timber and held nothing but a rough-hewn bed covered with furs and a pile of tangled equipage, bits of steel and leather peeking from behind the edge of a shield in one corner.
"There," he said with satisfaction, rubbing his hands together.
That should be warm enough for your thin blood, Dangeline.
He eyed me, the unnerving shrewdness back in his gaze.
I know what you are, Dangeline, that you are trained to serve your goddess whore. Kilbahar's men told me that I would pay the purchase price when I could have had a village girl for free but for the cost of a raid. We have done it before, you know.
Yes, I said. I knew. I thought of Alcuin, whose village had been burned by the Scaldi. I thought of how the screams of the women had echoed in his ears as he rode astride Delaunay's pommel.
What do you wish of me, my lord?
What? Gunter Arnlaugsen grinned, stretching his massive arms wide in the firelit bedroom. Light glittered on Melisande's diamond.
Everything, Dangeline, everything.
It is funny how despair can so soon become an old companion. What he asked, I gave. Not everything I had to offer, but everything he might desire. I was not fool enough to spend the coin of my skill all at once, and indeed he was too young and too crude in the ways of Nama to have grasped its value. But what I gave him, you may be sure, was beyond any price he had known to ask. If I thought before that I knew what it was to serve Nama, I learned that evening that I had grasped only the smallest part of it. On their wandering, Nama lay in the stews with strangers for love of Eloa and Eloa alone. I had done it for coin and my own pleasure. Only now did I grasp what it was she had done. For my own part, I would not have cared over much if I lived or died. Jocelyn thought I had betrayed him, but it was for his sake, and for Alcuin and Delaunay and his oath to Isandre de la Courcelle, I had to live by any means I could. I had nothing else to live for, save vengeance. The arousement alone was enough for my scaldy lord. I had barely begun the languissement when he gave a mighty whoop and toppled me onto his fur-clad bed, harpooning me with the gusto of a starving whaler. Melisande's diamond dangled from his neck and brushed my face as he plunged into me, burning like a brand. There is a point, always, where I no longer control either my patron's desires nor my own. I gazed over Gunter's shoulder, the room swimming red in my vision, gritted my teeth, and wept at my body's inevitable betrayal. Delaunay had lied when he had set his value upon me. I can make of her such a rare instrument that princes and queens will be moved to play exquisite music upon her, he had said. A rare instrument I was, that sang at a scaldy's crude thrusting. Pinioned under my master's hairy, heaving bulk, I came shuddering to climax, and despised all I was, and most especially the part that savoured the humiliation of it. In the hall I had to endure his strutting and boasting, and the envy of his thanes. It was not so hard compared to what had gone before, but still it galled me. Hatevik saw and paused in passing to lay a kind hand upon my arm. "His mouth is large," she said gently, "but his heart is larger. Don't take it so ill, child." I looked at her without answering. If I found compassion in my soul later for Gunter Arnlaugsen, I had none that night. Whatever she saw in my eyes, it sent her hurrying away. I cannot recall the verses that Gunter sang that night. Well-trained as my memory is, there are times when there is a kind of healing in forgetfulness. It sufficed that my reputation was made there in the great hall. That I remember all too well. Dangeline I was, they said, and kin to the spirits of the night that visit a man in exquisite dreams, summoning forth his seed for their own pleasure by the most delightful wiles. Only Gunter had mastered me by force of his prowess, and made me cry out his name, binding me to his will. So they thought, and I let them think it. And this I remember, that it was the first I heard the murmurs among his thanes, who thought I listened not, that Gunter was minded to give me to Voldemar Selig at the All-Thing, the great meeting of the tribes, and thus win the favour of the Blessed. Once again, then, I would be a gift fit for a prince. Well, and it was no consolation. I wondered at a man that even Gunter Arnlaugsen spoke of in tones of awe, and I feared. I thought of Jocelyn somewhere, shivering in the cold, and prayed he kept the wit to stay alive, for I feared I wouldn't survive this alone. I thought of Alcuin and Delaunay. Delaunay most of all, his beautiful, noble face, the intelligent eyes forever dimmed, and I wept for him, alone by the fire, for the first time. Great tearing sobs racked me, and the raucous Scaldi grew strangely silent. Their eyes, curious and sympathetic, watched me with strangers' gazes. I gulped for air and rubbed the tears from my eyes. "You do not know me," I said to them in Dangeline, looking defiantly at their uncomprehending faces. "You do not know what I am. If you mistake the yielding in me for weakness, you are fools for it." Still they stared, and there was no cruelty in it, only curiosity and incomprehension. I had a longing then, so acute I felt it in the marrow of my bones, to be home, to have my feet on Dangeline's soil, where Eloa trod with his companions. "There," I said in Scaldic, reaching out to point to a crude lyre in a warrior's hand. I didn't know the word for it. "Your instrument. May I borrow it?" He gave it over wordlessly, though his closest companions laughed and shouted. I bowed my head and tuned it, as my old music master had taught me, running in my head the lines of a poetic translation. I had a gift for it. Delaunay's studies had taught me that much. When I had done, I lifted my head and looked around me. "By right of your laws, I am bond slave to Gunter Arnlaugsen," I said softly. "But by the laws of my own country, I have been betrayed and sold against my will. I am Dangeline, and born to the soil on which Eloa shed his blood. This is the song we sing when we are far from home." I sang then the exile lament of Telesis de Mornay, the king's poet. It was not written for the Scaldic tongue, which is harsh to the ear, and I had not worked properly on the translation, but the Scaldi of Gunter's steading understood it, I think. I have said it, and it is true, but I have no great skill at song. But I am Dangeline. I would pit the lowliest Dangeline shepherd against the mightiest singer among the Scaldi, and wager on the shepherd each time. We are all of us, no matter how faint the thread of blood, the science of Eloa and his companions. We are what we are. So I sang, and put in the words as I sang them my farewell to Alcuin and Delaunay, and my promise to Jocelyn Verai that I had not forgotten what I was, and my love for all those who yet lived, for Hyacinth and Telesis de Mornay, and Master Tialar, Gaspard de Trevelyan, Quintilius Rouse, and Cecily La Vaux-Perrin, for the night court in all its faded glory, and for all that came to mind when I conjured the word home. When I was done, there was silence, and then a roar of approval. Hardened warriors shook tears from their eyes, clapping and shouting for me to sing again. It was not the response I had expected. I had not reckoned, then, on the deep streak of sentimentality that runs in the Scaldi nature. They love to weep as much as they love to fight and wager. Gunter was shouting over the din, flushed with triumph, proud of an ever of his conquest. I shook my head and passed the lyre. I had no other tunes to hand but I could work into Scaldic, and I was wise enough to rest on these laurels. Whatever cost I had paid that night, I had gained some small advantage, though for that, too, there would be a price. I heard it again in the murmurs when Gunter proceeded with me from the hall, his face beaming, his hand in the small of my back, as he steered me back to his room. He was a young man, Gunter Arnlaugsen, and tireless after their fashion. There was no shame among the Scaldi, and I could feel his eagerness when he brushed up behind me, his considerable phallus erect and straining at the front of his trews. It would be some time before he wearied of this. To my dismay, I felt the answering moisture between my own legs. I would have wept again, but my eyes at least were dry. I concentrated instead on the murmurs.
He would be a fool not to give her up, I heard. Even Voldemar Selig has nothing like that.
A gift fit for princes. I went obediently toward my own personal hell.
Chapter 42. Embers smoldered in the hearth in Gunter's bedroom. He lay beside me, deep in slumber, rumbling sounds emanating from his broad chest. This, too, was a strangeness to me. Never in all my days as a servant of Narmar had I shared sleep with a patron. He had fallen soundly asleep with one arm flung over me, but hadn't woken when I'd cautiously moved it. As well to know it, there was no lock on the bedroom door. Likely I could slip out without waking him. Gunter seemed to have no fear of my trying to escape. Rightly so, since I feared the snow and the journey as much as capture. But mayhap there was some merit in his casual trust. As I lay awake, considering the possibilities, I saw it. It was not, I feared, an option I liked. I liked it not at all, in truth, and the prospect of success was as terrifying in its own way as failure. Still, it had to be tried. Unfortunately, this was easier said than done. In the morning I attended Gunter at his breakfast, serving him with the unobtrusive grace that was a hallmark of Sirius House. It pleased him well enough, and I had hopes that he was in a generous mood, but when I asked permission to see Jocelyn, he slewed his gaze round at me with that canny look.
"Nay, he's a hellion, that one. Let him stew in the kennels a while longer. I'll not show him softness till he learns to heel to the hand as feeds him," he said, laughing. "Leastwise, he's making some new friends. A Dangeline lordling doesn't often get to meet, eh?"
Poor Jocelyn, I thought, and let the matter go for that day. Gunter patted me on the head and went out from the great hall to do whatever it was he did while away, betimes hunting, I later learned, and betimes making the rounds of the farms on his steading, seeing that all was well with his carles. So I was left to idle once more, only now there was some resentment in the glances of the women, whose labours seemed more onerous than mine. I would have traded places with any one of them, but they had no way to know it, and no reason to understand it. Hatevik resisted him, but Gunter was accounted a handsome man, I learned, and no small prize for the woman who would get him to plight his troth with her. Never skilled at doing nothing, I asked for pen and paper, that I might work out more translations of Dangeline songs for my meagre repertoire. They stared at me, uncomprehending. The Skaldi have no proper written language, but for a magical system of runic sigils they call Futhark. Odin, the All-Father, gave them to his children, they say, and there is virtue in them. I do not laugh at this, for it was Shemhazai who taught the Dangelines to write. It is my thought that he made a better job of it, but then I am biased. At any rate, there was neither pen nor paper to be had in the steading, so I made do with a clean-swept table and a burnt twig. Happily, the Skaldi women were intrigued by my charcoal scratchings, and their hostility eased as I explained what it was I did. They taught me songs, then, that I had never heard, Skaldic songs, but not of war, songs of life, of the harvest, of courtship, of love, of childbearing and loss. Some I still remember, but I wish I'd had paper to write them down. What the Skaldi lacked in melody and tone, they made up for in surprisingly beautiful imagery, and I do not think any scholar has catalogued these homely poems of house and hearth. So it was that I had more songs to sing that night, Dangeline and Skaldic alike, and they were well received. Gunter dandled me on his knee and beamed. I was something of a luck charm to the Skaldi, it seemed, with this sorcerous gift of tongues. The second night passed much like the first. I saw that Gunter was well pleased, and slept the sleep of deep exhaustion, and repeated my request in the morning. Again he denied it, and I bided to ask again after the third night.
"When he is tamed, I will show him kindness," he repeated to me, tugging at my curls and grinning. "Why do you persist, little dove? Have I not pleased you well enough between the furs? Your cries say as much."
He shared his grin with the room then. "That is my gift from my patron god, my lord," I said somberly to him. "I am marked with his sign." I touched the outer corner of my left eye.
"Like the petal of a rose floating on dark waters," Gunter agreed, drawing me forward to plant kisses on both eyelids.
"Yes." I pulled away from him, kneeling and gazing upward. "But I am bound to Jocelyn Verai by his oath to his patron god, and if I may not see him, our gods may turn their faces away in disfavor. Such gifts as I have will turn to dust in my mouth." I paused, then said, "It is a matter of honor, my lord. He will die rather than answer to your hand. But if he sees that I have yielded to you, and Kushiel favors me still, he may relent." Gunter considered it.
"All right, then," he said,
and hoisted me to my feet, clapping me on the behind.
"You may see the boy, that he may make peace with his gods. But let him know, that if he does not come soon, I'll have no use for him. He eats more than a hound, that one, and less value in his service."
He shouted for his thanes,
"Harold, Knut, take her to see the wolf cub, and see that he doesn't harm her," he added ominously.
They sprang up, grinning, eager to escort me anywhere. I retrieved my fur cloak and went with them as the doors of the great hall were opened. It was not far to the kennels, and the snow was trodden solid. Still Harold and Knut escorted me with care, helping me solicitously over the rough patches. Whatever I was here, I was something to be valued. The dogs were penned in a crude fence and had a low building to shield them from the weather. Harold the Beardless leaned over and pounded on the roof of it, shouting. I heard the sound of chains stirring from within. When Jocelyn emerged, I gasped. The Castlean looked awful. His long hair was matted and wild, his eyes glaring through it. He bore a manacle about his neck that had chafed him raw, and his ashen attire was wholly unsuited to the cold. He crouched on his haunches in the packed snow, ignoring the dogs that sniffed around him, treating him as one of their own. For all that, he was d'Angeline and beautiful. "Let me in to see him," I said to Knut. He gave me a dubious look, but opened the latch on the gate. I went in and crouched opposite Jocelyn. "Jocelyn," I murmured in our shared tongue, "I need to talk to you."
"Traitor,"
he spat at me, scrabbling at the fetid snow of the kennel yard and hurling a handful at me.
"Scaldic-speaking, treacherous daughter of a whore! Leave me alone!"
I dodged most of the snow and wiped the rest from my face. "Do you want to know the face of treachery, Castlean?" I retorted angrily. "Isidore d'Eglamour is paying the Scaldi to raid Carmeline villages. How do you like that?" Jocelyn, who had turned away to dig up another handful of snow, turned back to me, a questioning and thankfully human light in his eyes.
"Why would he do that?"
"I don't know," I said softly in d'Angeline, "save that it has allowed him to rally the allies of Cumlach around his flag again and build up his own armies. He even asked for command of Baudouin's glory seekers, you know. I heard it." On his haunches, Jocelyn sat still and stared at me.
"You really think he seeks to overthrow the crown?"
"Yes." I reached forward and took his hands. "Jocelyn, I don't think I can make it through these lands. You can, and I can free you. Gunter has no guard on me, no chain. I can get out of the great hall tonight. I can get you arms and clothing and a tinderbox at least. You have a chance. You can make it to the city and deliver Rouse's message, and tell them what d'Eglamour is about."
"What about you?"
He was still staring.
"It doesn't matter," I said fiercely.
"Gunter means to bring me to the All-Thing, to give me to Voldemar Selig. I'll learn what I can and do what I may, but you have a chance to escape."
"No."
He shook his head, looking sick.
"No. If you are no traitor, Fedra, I can't. My oath is to Carsiel, and not the crown. I cannot leave you."
"Carsiel bids you protect the crown," I cried. Harold and Knut glanced over, and I lowered my voice.
"If you would serve me, do this thing, Jocelyn." "You don't know."
He bowed his head, pressing the heels of his hands into his eyes, despairing.
"You don't understand.
It has naught to do with thrones and crowns. Cassiel betrayed God because God himself had forgotten the duty of love and abandoned Eloah ben Yeshua to the whims of fate, to the point of damnation and beyond. He is the perfect companion. If you are true, if you are true, I cannot abandon you, Phaedra Nodelone."
"Jocelyn," I said, tugging his hands down. I glanced around at Harold and Knut, waving them back. "Jocelyn, I ask you to do this thing with all that is in me. Can you not obey?"
He shook his head, miserable.
"Do you not know what we call Eloah and the other companions in the service of Cassiel? The misguided. Ask me anything but this. Cassiel cared naught for lands and kings. I cannot abandon you."
Thus was my plan, which was a good one, resigned to the midden heap. "All right," I said sharply, in a tone that brought his head up so quickly it rattled his chains. "Then if you would serve me as companion, do so. You merit naught, chained in the kennel like a dog."
He gulped and swallowed hard. Humility does not come easy to Castellines.
"How may I serve, then, my Lady Phaedra, O slave of the Scaldi?"
Harold and Knut were leaning on the fence, watching with interest. They may have understood none of what passed between us, but they saw Jocelyn willing to listen, something none of them had seen before. "First," I said relentlessly, "you will learn to be a good slave and make yourself useful. Cut wood, fetch water, whatever is needful. Gunter Arnlaugsson has half a mind to slay you.